Hey, hello. If you're a new listener who came because you're a fan of author Juliet Kemp, or if you've been around for a while, welcome up. If you find that you love what you're about to hear, please take just a second to subscribe to Sonatotum in the very podcast app you're listening to right now, so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. And don't worry, I'll remind you again in just a little bit. Thanks. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 105. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I've been an independent author and creator for the better part of a quarter of a century, and my day job is helping other authors and creative folks bring their works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. It's not my first rodeo, but as I like to say, the venue and the horses and the bulls and especially the clowns keep changing. So I try to maintain an attitude of an experienced beginner and use this platform to share with you my own experiences as I try to do those three things: making things, finding success, and staying healthy and sane. Every other episode, I invite another author, writer, playwright, poet, somebody who works with words in some form, to join me for an evergreen, value-packed conversation about those three tentpole subjects. Today, it's my pleasure to share with you my conversation with Juliet Kemp. Juliet Kemp is a queer, non-binary writer. They live in London, by the river, with their partners, kid, and dog. The first book of their fantasy series, The Deep and Shining Dark, was on the Locus 2018 recommended reads list. The fourth and final book, The City Revealed, came out in 2023. They have written several novellas, and their short fiction has appeared in venues including Uncanny, Analog, and Cast of Wonders. They were shortlisted for the WSFA Small Press Award in 2020 and 2023, and had a short story in the anthology Transgalactic Bike Ride, which was Lambda Award shortlisted in 2021. When not writing or child wrangling, Juliet knits, indulges their fountain pen habit, and tries to fit an ever-increasing number of plants into a microscopic back garden. That's all from Juliet's website, and you can find out more at julietkemp.com. That's JULIETKEMP.com. Let's get into my conversation with Juliet Kemp. Oh, and stick around, because when I come back after the talk, I'm going to have an opportunity for, well, most of you listening to get one of three of my books for free. So hang around for that. But for now, here's my conversation with Juliet Kemp. Juliet Kemp, what do you create?
I write science fiction and fantasy, novels, novellas, short stories. I don't think I've written or had published at least a novelette-length thing yet, but I would absolutely not rule it out. And once in a while, I write a little bit of nonfiction, sort of in the same space.
Now, science fiction, fantasy—that's a broad brush. Do you have a particular subgenres you like to play in? Go a little deeper on that.
My fantasy series. It's called the Marek series, and there's four books in it. The last one came out, which is the final one in the series, came out start of 23. And that is queer norm epic fantasy. with magic and complicated interpersonal relationships and a little smidge of politics. And I guess the thing that I'm most interested in as a sort of theme is ideas about kindness and about how people can do things together. I'm interested in cooperation, sometimes reluctant cooperation, but I'm interested in how people make things and change things. And I guess sort of hope punk, solar punk, that kind of space is where I tend to write in, because it's something I think about a lot. And I'm quite interested in politics with a small P, sort of in the sense of how decisions are made or how people achieve things, how people do things.
I'm going to want to dive deeper into all of that, because it's sparking a lot of along the lines of a lot of thoughts that I often have about fiction. So we're going to have fun with that. But first, I always like to follow up the what you create question with, in the spirit of 3 and 4 year olds everywhere. But why do you create?
That's a great question. And obviously, as one discovers with 3 and 4 year olds, it's often quite hard to answer. I mean, to some extent, I do it because I do it, which is, you know, because I make things up in my head, even if I'm not intending to. And if I don't channel that into a relatively useful, is not the right word, but, you know, if I don't make up stories, I start making up random stories about everything around me, and those aren't always helpful. Like, I'm the sort of person who will find myself having a mental argument with a real person in my head, none of which has happened, because I've just started inventing something. So it's like, it's better to create those arguments with the fictional people, and then I don't have to remind myself not to be cross with the person when I see them next time, because they're not real. It's okay.
Yeah, the old "I'm angry at you because I had a dream" kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, well, what you start thinking about, maybe a difficult conversation will happen, and you start thinking it through, and then you get completely, completely carried away, and you're inventing a whole bunch of things that will never happen. So I write stories because I write stories all the time in my head, and I might as well write them down. And I write them because I have fun ideas. And I found that, you know, when you get ideas, you can either kind of think, oh, that's neat, and let them fly away, or you can nurture them. And nurturing them is fun. So I guess I write stories because it's fun, and because I feel better when I write stories, and because I'm interested in people and worlds and ideas. And I guess maybe this is the way that I explore that, through making stuff up about them.
Yeah.
Rather than working in more kind of nonfiction spaces, as it were.
Right. I'll say, you know, that I definitely do the same thing, sort of being a plotter in real life, you know, thinking things through that may happen or may not happen or may not have happened, and absolutely running those little two-person plays in my head that may never see the real life stage. But what do you think? Why do you think you do that? Is there something that you could think back to that maybe inspired? Because it's a form of I'm gonna suggest. Again, based on the fact that I do it too, that sort of preemptive conversation thing, imaginary conversation, it's a form of problem solving, and perhaps, and you can say, no, that's ridiculous. Perhaps a form of controlling, or at least reducing anxiety, almost like a preemptive strike.
Yeah.
Does that ring true, or do you think there might be another origin for that for you?
No. I think that kind of sense of control. I think fake control. because the people in real life do not behave like the imaginary person you imagine. But yes, I get that. I think I do sometimes do it. To have that sense of, I know what might happen, or I think I know what might happen, or what could happen. It's kind of building a little model of the situation, and then I feel more on top of it. And I do sometimes experience anxiety. That is a thing I've dealt with in the past. And so, I think there's a bit of that. I also, I think maybe it partly originates when I was a kid. I sometimes found it difficult to understand how people work. Like a lot of what I learned about the world, I wound up learning from fiction. I learned from stories. And I think maybe that I'm still sometimes doing that, that making up stories is a way of trying to kind of see into other people, or to make little models of how people work, and to try and work out how the people might behave. Yeah. And perhaps when I'm making up, you know, real actual stories with my entirely fictional people, to try on somebody else's brain for size, as it were, to try and get further into the mind of someone who isn't me. And again, obviously, that's a bit of a cheat because all of them are me.
Right. But that's a way that that's a self-discovery thing too, right?
Yeah. And certainly, you know, if I think back to all the stuff that I read as a child and indeed as an adult, all of those little worlds that exist inside my head and that I still kind of believe in, they're all kind of floating around in there and informing how I think about the world. So I guess making up my own versions of those worlds and those people is a way of continuing that process.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And it makes sense, especially in the context of, you know, you already mentioned how your focus seems to be the small p politic and human interrelations and just how people get along or not. and even the emphasis on, you know, you called it hope punk, the emphasis on, you know, positive outcomes and cooperation, ideally, and, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, it all sounds of a piece. It all sounds like your sort of creative life project.
I think of fiction as being one of the ways that, in fact, we generally as humans make sense of the world.
Yes.
And so I, you know, if I'm feeling I can't quite think of the right word, grandiose is maybe overstating, but you know, in an ideal world, I would like to write things that help other people make sense of the world. You know, that's one of the things, or to contribute to the way that the stories that we as a society or as individuals use to structure our lives. Because I think that the stories that you have available to understand the world affect how you interpret it.
Absolutely.
And you can, you know, those can be both positive and negative.
Yeah. I mean, we know that, there's been studies and I'll try to find some and cite them in the show notes, but there's been studies that show that reading novels increases one's sense of empathy, one's ability to be empathic. And since, you know, people think of empathy as a net positive, but really empathy is just being able to understand another person's point of view. It doesn't necessarily mean that their point of view is going to be a good one. So literature is, you know, it's an engine of empathy. So I agree that writing fiction, and I want to talk a little bit about your nonfiction too, but writing fiction as a way to kind of suss out not only all of the sort of probable outcomes in our own lives, but to better understand and help others better understand each other. That's very much that rings true for me. That's very much why I tend to write fiction, and what I'm looking for when I'm writing fiction. And it seems like this might be some of your stuff. The idea, it struck me when you said non-epic fantasy, and immediately my brain was like, wait, what is that? You know, what is the difference between epic and non-epic fantasy? But also the fact that it sounds like a lot of your stuff is very, very, very character-driven and primarily focused on the character. Would that be accurate?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I do have the kind of, yes, at least I hope I do, the sort of plot sense of, you know, there is also external threats and all that. But the thing I'm most interested in is, the characters and the relationships and how people are reacting, I suppose, to those threats. And as I think I said earlier, I'm particularly interested in how you can cooperate, mm-hmm. or how people can cooperate, even sometimes reluctantly or with or across disagreement. Mm-hmm. That kind of sense of, well, I don't like this person, or I do not agree with all of this person, but we are both actually pulling in the same direction right now, so we can work on that, even if we then go and fight about something else. I find that fascinating.
How do you build coalitions? The enemy of my enemy and all that stuff.
Yeah. But doing that without, maybe whilst still disagreeing mm-hmm. on other things at the same time, not, I'm interested in complications.
It's messy.
Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. Messiness. People are messy. Relationships are messy. Yeah. All sorts of relationships are messy. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah. It's funny. So you mentioned, of course, I still consider plot and whatnot. And I mean, I think there it is right there, kind of underneath what you've already said, is that the sort of plot character, there is no line of demarcation. You can't have one without the other. I mean, you could have a plot where it's just, let's have 200 pages of just watching the leaves change color. but unless there's a character to observe it and a character to be affected by it, there's no story. It's a minor frustration of mine when people use terms like, well, is it plot driven or character driven? It's like, no, it's all character driven, right? You can't really, the characters are going to affect the plot and they're going to react to things that are external and that they objectively experience,
Yeah, but you do definitely get SF in particular, some SF in particular that is very much about the ideas. Like, I love Greg Egan, but I read Greg Egan for the ideas rather than for the detailed inner life of the characters.
Well, I don't mean necessarily that their life is presented in great detail, but there has to be.
Oh, yes, but they are there and they are doing stuff. Yeah, well, that's true.
There has to be some sort of change in the characters. Even if it's, that guy got blown up.
Big change. I get you.
Yeah. I think of Greg Bear, who's particularly good at that. High concept stories, and Greg Benford too. Thinking of the Killer Bees, right? As they used to be known, Benford Bear and Bryn. big high concept, widescreen stories, but managed to make you care about the characters as well. And so, kind of on the subject of genres and those. Those lines or blurry borders between them. You said non-epic fantasy, and the reason my ears perked up is because 15 different people will give you 30 different descriptions of what epic fantasy is. So what do you consider non-epic fantasy?
I think maybe it's trying to get at something, because epic fantasy does tend to mean anything secondary world, basically, anything that's not urban fantasy, which is its own specific genre. I was trying to describe the Merrick series as urban fantasy because they're set in a city, but urban fantasy means something really specific about what sort of city.
I made the same mistake with my last novel.
And I kind
novel.
Of knew that at the time. I was like, it's urban fantasy, but not like that. And then, everyone was like, that is too confusing. Don't do that.
Yeah.
But I guess trying to get at something around what does epic fantasy mean? It can mean so many different things. And I think the stuff I've been writing, at least so far, doesn't feel to me to have, I feel like epic fantasy should have an epic sweep, it should be across huge nations and worlds, and, I'm waving my hands around. You can't see it because it's audio, baby. And what I'm writing is secondary world fantasy, and if you have to tick a genre box, it counts as epic fantasy, but I don't feel like it hasn't got that spread. That's not deliberately, I didn't want to write that.
And then there's the smaller boxes.
Genre's hard.
Genres are stupid.
Where do you put it on the shelf so that people can get at it? Right. You know, so that people get in the bookshop is really the question. It's asking whether that's a virtual or real shelf. And I guess in that sense, you know, it goes with other sorts of epic fantasy. It's that sort of fantasy. But yes, I think that's maybe it's a term I think that should catch on. Non-epic fantasy.
Well, and then there's the smaller boxes of low and high fantasy, you know, which again is completely confusing to me.
And I'm actually not sure I understand those ones, so I might not be able to comment with any intelligence. You know?
I think you're right that it's safe to say, like, all right, if it's not the prototypical farm boy to prince quest story structure with, you know, 15 different countries and large landscapes that they cross, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're right. That's a safe assumption of epic fantasy until you find somebody who's like, oh, this wasn't epic fantasy.
Well, I was going to say, because I don't, you know, like you say, there are 30 different definitions for 15 different people. So obviously if somebody, I wouldn't necessarily want to contradict anyone saying it. And maybe to some extent, you know, when I was reading stuff as a teenager in the 90s, I kind of imprinted on what was epic fantasy at the time, which was very large sweep, as you say, kind of, you know, swords and sorcery, and which I thoroughly enjoyed. But now I'm like, that's what I mean when I think of epic fantasy. And obviously people write many different things that also go in that box, many of which I've read and enjoyed.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, the frustrating thing.
It's just the words are really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, it's ultimately about just figuring out where it goes in the bookstore, virtual or not. And that's the other thing is I think, well, I've observed that readers and authors both, have kind of conflated the idea of genre, which is, let's, you know, really originally is supposed to be a marketing tool. It's a taxonomy, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and taxonomies are hard too. So.
You know, but I think it's been sort of morphed into, you know, no, these books do that. You know, the obsession with, well, does your fill in the blank genre have all the right tropes?
Yeah, and that's not really for me anyway. That's not the interesting question.
It's not
the interesting question about a book. It's right. Like I want to ask other things. I mean, you mentioned taxonomy, and therefore I immediately think of the Archive of Our Own, the fan work fiction site, which works on tags and therefore can expand their, you can expand your kind of what you want to read or what you think you're writing far beyond the sort of genre labels that we deal with in a bookshop situation. And I do like that.
I love that idea. In fact, I did a podcast episode last year cheekily called, you know, How to Fix the Amazon Bookstore. It's like, yeah, fixed it for you. And it was entirely based on that is rather than these really arbitrary and granular categories that they've got going, what, hundreds at least, right?
They're very confusing when you try and navigate them.
In either direction,
I think.
is to have it be a more flat, non-hierarchical, tag-based kind of thing. And I know there's a site, what is it, Story? There's a newish site, sort of a Goodreads competitor, Story something or other.
Yes. No, I can't remember the name either, but I know the one you mean. Yes.
It's another one that'll be in the show notes. I'll have time to look it up later. But yeah, that's as I understand it, they're going for that. They're going for, you know, assign tags to this so that you can kind of build your own kind of thing. And I love that idea because I think that readers are being trained by genre categories. And it could be detrimental. I mean, you mentioned, you know, as being a young person and reading these books that have, you know, shaped what you like to write and read now. And I bet you weren't like, oh, well, this doesn't have this particular thing, so I'm, you know, it, I fear that the adherence to genre and to the limits of that sort of trope based genre based kind of thing leads to people staying in their lanes as readers, you know, without that, that sense of discovery. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's good to be able to do both. Like, I've definitely had sort of moments in my life where I've been like, I really want to read about 14 very close versions of the same thing. Like if I'm reading, if I'm going through a romance phase in particular, I go through sort of a phase of maybe about a week where it's just very soothing to read a very similar take on the sort of very, and to know that I'm getting a certain set of tropes. That can be quite, you know, if it's a difficult week, you maybe don't want to read something that's challenging, or I don't want to read something that I'm going to have to think about. I want to read something that feels satisfying and a little bit predictable. But if I read that all the time, and as I say, I go through phases, and that come to the end of the phases, I start thinking, yeah, okay, I need something chewier now, or differently chewy. So I think there are advantages to being able to sort of nail down, you know, go down the list to your particular sort of trope and to look at the cover and the blurb and be like, I know where that one's going. That is what I want today. And I talked about the archive of our own. I think that's one of the things people often get out of fanfic. You know, you find your tag, you know, Hurt Comfort, whatever, and you're like, this is, I know what I'm getting out of this, and that's what I want to read, and that's what I'm going to go and read. But yes, I think the downside of that is getting too shut into a kind of a narrow set of boundaries. And say, for me personally, I go through comfort reading phases, and then I go through, right, I'm going to try and read something that is outside of that zone, maybe right outside of my normal zone to challenge myself a bit more, or maybe just something that's like, you know, what has come out recently that people have been saying good things about. Yeah. Let's go find that. So yeah, balance in all things perhaps, but I'm not convinced that the current approach to genre, when it's being sold either in Amazon or in bookshops, is necessarily hitting either of those very well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you know, being a small child, and it's all new, right? So you know, it's funny because I can say I broadly, at least at first, stayed in the sort of the science fiction fantasy realm. You know, it would be the first section I'd go to in the public library, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, just that sense of discovery. I don't know. I guess it's, you know, it's the old man yelling at cloud. I want folks to experience that still, you know.
And I think that is harder when you're buying online. Like if you go to a physical bookshop or to a public library, there's a whole bunch of stuff on the shelves, and you know, maybe the librarians or the booksellers have put some stuff face out with a little label on it to encourage you to read it, and maybe there's other things you're just looking through and you're looking for, I don't know, interesting typeface or a cover that looks cool, or it just so happens that there's something next to the author you were looking for anyway, and that sort of sense of discovery I think is harder to do when in online sales, when you know, when people are buying stuff online, and so maybe that's part of what's making that harder. I was thinking about being a child in the public library and going, you know, making a beeline for all the there was a bunch of Doctor Who novelizations in the 80s when I was that age, and I read my way through all of those, and I knew what they, you know, I knew where they were on the shelf, and I went and looked at them, but eventually I did run out and have to borrow something else.
yep. Oh, believe me, I've got my comfort reads. You know, I think probably the first thing that I blasted through as a child was the Tarzan books. And then you know, later on, in fact, I've fallen quite a bit behind, as I understand it, the George R. R. Martin Wild Cards shared world anthology. Yeah. I mean, that was just a sweet spot for me, a shared world and superheroes. Oh gosh, I'm, you know, 18, 19 year old me. It was like, yes. How these couldn't come out fast enough. kind of still on that train of thought about genre and marketing. And since you are someone who it sounds like, as I said, your books don't quite fit that perfectly categorized, center of the bullseye for the genre distinctions. What have been the challenges there in getting your stuff to the right readers?
Marketing is just a bit of a nightmare, to be honest. I think for most people, obviously some people have, either hit the right moment or have a big publisher behind them that's a big publisher that is spending money and time, because not everyone who's published with a big five publisher gets those resources. Mm-hmm. So my books are out with small presses, I've worked with some absolutely amazing small presses. Elsman, who published my Marek series, are just fantastic, particularly fantastic to work with. I've been so lucky. They're just great. Mm. But they're also small and they have limited resources and limited reach and all of this. Trying to let people know what you're writing and that they might like it, I think is a difficult, because there are an awful lot of books for people to read. And I find it's not something that I like. Some people enjoy it. I do not enjoy that. And I've certainly, when my books first started coming out, I found it harder than I do now. It's just this horrible cringe factor of like, I cannot possibly say, I've written this thing, you might like it. Like, what if you don't like it? And I told you might, and I was wrong. That's just terrible. And obviously, there's the whole social media stuff, which has in the last year or so become much more complicated. But even when Twitter was working, quote unquote, as a way to reach people, it was still quite difficult to do. And as it got harder to do that, unless you were effectively paying for advertising. Same with Facebook. Like, there was a point where you could have a page on Facebook and people could subscribe to it, and then they would see what you posted, and then that stopped happening. Like, you could have it and they could subscribe to it, but they wouldn't see what you posted necessarily. Yeah. And Twitter's the same. Like, my observation is that, and I've been on Twitter since like 2007 or something.
Yeah, that's right around when it started, me too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Back when it was a collection of SMSs in a trench coat.
Yep.
And I used it exclusively for keeping in touch with people at festivals. But even like, I don't know, 5 years ago, if you had sort of 1,000 followers, which is not many, but you could think if you posted something, a fair chunk of those 1,000 would see it. Mm-hmm. And that is just no longer true. As far as I can tell, there's a fighting chance if you post something, it just nobody will see it at all. And it's not just because fewer people are on the platform, although I think that's true, because of everything that's happened to Twitter.
Sure. Lately. The super villain. Yeah.
But also, there have been changes such that it's not put in front of them, even if they were there. Like, yeah, there's all this messing around with the feed, and that's been happening more and more in recent years. And it's got much, much worse in the last year. So now we're all scattered to, Blue Sky or Mastodon or Threads or some other stuff. I don't even know. And they're all smaller, at least at present, and they have different issues. Like, I'm on Blue Sky, and as far as I can see on Blue Sky, people who subscribe to me, which is not that many because it's not been around long, do tend to see, like, I get reactions when I post a thing, which had just stopped happening on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And even from, people who I, personal friends were not, reacting to stuff I put on Twitter. And now I'm seeing more. So on Blue Sky, you get more reactions, but there's fewer people, and it's the same on Mastodon. I've gone off into a rant about the limitations of social media, but the problem is that is one of the ways that small authors, mm-hmm, or small presses can, in theory, get in touch with readers. You can talk directly to readers. That's brilliant. But it's really hard to make that happen in the... It was always hard, and I think it's gotten harder again. And I don't think that's an original comment. I've heard other people saying the same thing, that you've spent years and years and years building up this audience on your social media platform of choice, and then it just disappears because they change the algorithm, or because a idiot billionaire buys a platform and runs into the ground.
Of course. Well, yeah, and that's almost always going to happen eventually.
It is sort of the life cycle of the internet, as far as I can tell.
Then the only thing that is kind of safe from that, I've found, is is building your own community. Mm. And usually that's through a mailing list, you know, because nobody can touch that. And those are people, you know, you're going to reach. I mean, sure, it's up to them to open the email, you know, but they got on the list, so they probably will.
Hard agree. That is the best way to do it. But it's slightly harder to get people to sign up to a mailing list than it is to get them to read a tweet. So it's you think about things like, you know, your marketing, what is not a pyramid, it's the other thing, funnel.
The funnel,
stuff like that. Yeah. That's slightly further down the list. I know a little bit about the technicalities of this, but only a very tiny bit. Marketing's not my strong point, and I keep trying to get better at it. Because I would like more people to read my books. I think they're all right. I think people might like them. At least some people might like them. And, you know, if more people read them, then that'd be great.
Absolutely. You know, it's like it's almost a personal cliche of mine. It's like, you know, I make things for people who like the kinds of things I make, you know, and let's just find them. And and that's the rub, right?
And in some ways, you know, you asked earlier, you know, why do you write? Why do you make stuff? And some of the answer to that is, you know, because I personally enjoy it, because I make stories up anyway, because that's just how my brain is. But if I just wanted to write things for my own, you know, personal satisfaction, then I would do that and not publish them.
Right? Yeah, right.
Part of the process of saying, actually, I would want to share this with other people. That's what publication's about. You're not just writing it. There's obviously, as with anybody else, any other creative, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I have written, maybe enjoyed writing and then looked at and gone, I don't think this one is for sharing. Or maybe I'll take a little bit of it out and put it into something else. But basically when you publish books, you want people to read them. That's the deal. That's part of the process. And that's the trickier bit.
So we talked a lot about how difficult it is and what doesn't work or what doesn't work anymore. What have you found that does?
That's hard to answer, partly because one of the downsides of traditional publishing, even with small press stuff, is that you don't have a direct link. So like you can go and do things like talking to nice people on podcasts or, talking on social media or sending out your mailing list or, going to conventions. And I have a faint sense that sometimes some of those things lead people to looking at the books and then maybe reading them, but it's very hard to get a really clear idea of that.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, because you're one removed because of the small press. I get that. Yeah, for sure. How much and you know, you don't have to give away everything, but how much does your publisher share with you in terms of their marketing results and, you know, the in the weeds analytics or?
Oh, not very much.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. They haven't got the resources to do loads of that stuff. They do a lot of in-person selling at conventions and they are great at that, at being like, you know, people come along and they're like, you would like this book. Here is this book. So that kind of hand selling.
Oh, that's great.
They're brilliant at it. But obviously that's like one person at a
time. Well, sure.
It's brilliant. And they're great. They're great at that. But in terms of other sorts of marketing resources, I think that's less available.
I understand. I get that. I've been almost entirely self-published, but I did. My first novel was kind of courted by a small press and we did a reissue through them. And the extent of their marketing was I was stoked to see it. It was kind of a childhood thrill to see, realized. They did a full page in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction shortly after it came out.
Yeah,
right? Yeah, that was awesome.
Nice.
Did it sell any books? I have no idea.
I was going to say it's tricky because selling, one of the pieces of conventional wisdom about marketing, right, is that people need to see, your thing like three times or seven times or whatever number it is that's being touted at the time. But broadly speaking, that advert itself may or may not have sold any books directly, but then somebody's seen that advert and then maybe they see a review or their mate recommends it to them. They're like, oh yeah, I saw an advert for that one. I'll try that one. You know, so it's not a sort of one-to-one relationship anyway.
Oh no, no, definitely not. Yeah.
But mega cool.
definitely like, cool. But I know that the biggest, and that's the tricky part with, you know, this whole marketing thing is with that particular book, I know that the biggest sales driver for the duration of my contract with them was a thing that I did, you know, you know, and I think that's just the way it is.
I was going to say the strong impression I've got from reading around is that unless you are like sort of mega juggernaut type author you have a large publisher who are throwing a lot of weight behind you, that mostly it is kind of
absolutely
what the author does that really shifts the needle. But as far as I can tell, it's also mostly witchcraft. Like we're all kind of throwing ideas around, but there's an awful lot of like, oh, well, I did this thing. One of the pieces of advice I remember I quite liked, partly because it fits with my personal prejudices, is that to some extent it's best just to do the stuff in the kind of marketing or awareness that you like.
Yes.
And try not to have too many expectations. So, you know, go and do readings at conventions or whatever and try and enjoy it. And if you absolutely hate it, maybe don't. Just right. Don't do that.
Yeah.
But don't go in there thinking, right, I'm going to sell like, you know, squillions of books. People are going to turn up and they're all going to buy them. Go in and try and enjoy the process of reading, even if it's two, as I have done a reading to four people. And rather than having the outcome is to go and have fun.
Right. And hey, you know, if you had a reading with four people, hopefully those were four people who were engaged, you know, and I would take that any day over a reading for 40 people or 400 where half of them are on their phones, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in that sort of sharpshooter rather than shotgun approach, you know. It's the right audience, not the largest audience that matters ultimately.
Because, you know, if you reach the person who really, the person or a person who really loves your books and then they tell other people that they love them, then all of that is, you know, that's good. That's good stuff. Yeah. And also, you know, we're talking about marketing and getting books in front of people's eyeballs, which is great, but also reaching one person who really loves what I wrote, that in itself, that's a success, right?
Have you encountered that situation where you are approached by that person, you know, whether it's directly in person or an email or whatever?
Yes, somebody at WorldCon. So cool.
And on top of that, they tell you something that they loved so much about your work that you had no clue or intention was in there.
I remember somebody, I was chatting to somebody in a queue for something or other at Worldcon, must have been in Dublin, and they looked at my badge and went, oh, you're Juliet, I read your book and loved it. And I do not remember what specifically they loved about it because I was too busy going, oh my goodness, I've read my book. They've just come up to me.
it's such wonderful validation, and not just the obvious ego stroke, but also that's the goal, right? You're trying to reach someone with this, you know, trying to transmit your thought into this other brain and to know that you've actually done it. Yeah, it's wonderful. And that's kind of a good segue into one of the sort of the tent poles of our conversations on Sonatotum, knowing full well that it's a fluid thing that could change over time. What is your sort of definition of success for your creative life, and how's it going?
I thought about this ahead of time because I know it's one of your things, and I also find it really difficult to define for myself.
I've historically found
it really difficult to celebrate things I do, and I have a shocking tendency to move the goalposts immediately. Like this sense of whatever I have just achieved is no longer an achievement because I have just achieved it. and therefore it no longer counts. And that is, you know, not very mentally healthy as an approach, I would say. So it's something that I have been consciously trying to get better at. I guess almost like being in the moment and being like, here is this thing that I wanted to achieve or that I am proud of achieving. And I'm going to sit here and like let myself have that moment. And I find that really difficult. You know, my impulse is just to move on. Like that's in the rearview mirror now. I must do something different, something better. So what do I define success as? And it is a moving goalpost. So I am trying, you know, I have published books. They are out there in the world and people are reading them, and that is success. And certainly before I had published any books, that was an important goal. And then the first book of mine that came out, I completely freaked out and found it very difficult to have any positive feelings about it at all. Not because I didn't like the book. I still think it's a good, The Deep and Shining Dark. I still think it's a good book. But because I was equally torn between like, this will come out and no one will read it and that will be terrible. And this will come out and people will read it and that will be terrible. It really felt like there was just no win condition. It was really, it felt absolutely terrifying. And I, you know, I know a lot of people are like, oh, my first book came out and it was, you know, such this great moment. No, for me, it was just really scary. And so I didn't really find myself able to appreciate that as a success at all. And it was a success. I had written a book, finished it, sent it to somebody who also liked it. And, you know, we did some editing and everything and it became better. And then like went out and people read it. All of those things are successes. And I've almost had to like sit back and celebrate that several years in arrears when I sort of thought about how I was approaching all of this. And that it wasn't great. So I am trying to get better at defining success as something closer to, I had an idea. I wanted to write the thing. I wrote the thing to a place where I was happy with it. And then it went out into the world. Like all of those things are successes. And obviously some projects don't meet all of those criteria. Because, you know, sometimes you get halfway through something, you know, halfway through a book and realize that it's not working. I've got at least one project that I've got like 120,000 words of that isn't right. Ouch. I've not ditched it forever.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to it and work out what's wrong with it. I don't think it's lost, but right now it's not. Yeah, right. That has not. Maybe. I guess the only success I could say is I wrote 121,000 words. In fact, I wrote them twice. And I'm still interested in what I was trying to do with it, but it's definitely in a halfway place.
That sounds like you're just, and we all, this hopefully is a lifetime thing. You may just not be the writer you need to be for it yet. Emphasis on yes. Yet.
I think I have some sense of what I need to do for that book. And yeah, I'm not ready to go back and work it out yet, but yeah. I have some sense of what needs to happen with it. And yeah, I do intend to do that. But anyway, so that idea, that sense of, I had an idea, I made the idea, I got it somewhere I've been happy with, and now it's gone out into the world. That's a success. That is a success. But I find that I also have to, I'm trying to balance that with wanting to become better, with having goals that stretch myself. So, you know, for example, I said I'm proud of the books I've written before, but it's also true that if I wrote now the book, you know, my first novel, I would write it a bit differently. And I think I would write it better. And it's not to say that I think it's a good book. People who are listening, you should totally try reading it. But obviously I would hope that in 6 years I have got better as a writer. And therefore, you know, if I could say, oh, well, actually I couldn't do any better than that after 6 more years of practice, that would sort of be like a fail, right?
Yeah.
One should be getting better.
I think so. Yeah.
So trying to balance that sense of I'm satisfied with a thing that I have done, and also, but I want to do better with the next thing. I think that's, I'm working on trying to feel both those things at the same time.
Well, sure. I think that's entirely valid. I mean, you mentioned moving the goalposts, and I get how that can be a sort of a self-esteem, sort of a diminishing one's own accomplishments. And you know, I'm not putting these on you. I'm saying these are possibilities. It's also, if I diminish the importance of what I've just done, then if it doesn't work, it's not that big of a deal. You know, and that's very different from, okay, I had the idea, I finished it, and it's out in the world, and the next one's going to be even better.
That's very different.
That's okay. I want to beat my personal best.
Yes. No, I think that sort of shifting goalposts is great. That sense of I've done this.
That's actually like reaching earlier.
Yeah. And now I want to ramp up, you know, now I think I can do this thing better. I think I think that's part of success over a career is shifting your goals in that sense.
Yeah.
The thing that I have struggled with the past is not letting myself appreciate the goal before mm-hmm. I'm moving on. And as you say, it's the downplaying it, or the other sort of flip side of that is a thing that I have, if I have done it, it can't have been that good. I think that's the thing that for me has been difficult, allowing myself to appreciate what I've done before I say, and now the next thing I'm going to try and do better.
Yeah, I try to do that with everything that I write in terms of fiction. I'm going to admit that nonfiction for me is it's easier, and I don't feel like it's as much of a push each time. But I think that's also because, you know, maybe because so many of us are now so used to blogging and you know, giving our opinions and writing in a conversational tone and all of that. But with the fiction, no, I hope that each time, and in fact, if I don't feel challenged in the process of it, I wonder, you know, okay, they say throughout their first five ideas, maybe I stopped early. Maybe this is a little too easy. You know, if I don't feel like this if I don't feel the burn, then I'm probably not getting anything from it, you know? I remember. Go ahead.
I was going to say, there's always the sort of that messy middle part where you're slogging through thinking, I don't trust this anymore. I don't know where I'm going with this. I thought I knew where I was going with this, and I'm not. And I think, you know, once you've written enough projects, I can now recognize that. It's this stage. So it's the first 20,000 words. You're like, yes, this is amazing. I love it. I'm so pleased with this. And then the next 20,000, you're like, still feeling good, but I'm beginning to have some doubts. And then there's about 40,000 where it's like, oh my God, this is terrible. It's the worst thing ever. And then you finish it and think, thank goodness. Never again. And then you look back and you're like, actually, this is all right.
You know what? I don't mean to, this is by no means a horn blowing flex or anything like that. I don't experience that because.
Oh, brilliant. Good for you.
Well, wait for it, because all of that uncertainty happens in the planning stage. And that could certainly stall me for a while. It stalled me on my current work in progress for a very long time because I hadn't figured out how the thing was actually going to be accomplished. You know, how the bones of the story, you know, I thought I knew the ending. I knew basically where I was going and what I was trying to say, you know, speaking of those underlying themes and things and the point I was going to make with this work of fiction. Because on pretty much anything bigger than a short story, I tend to be a planner. You know, I do a lot of pre-writing and pre-work that is writing before I start the actual manuscript draft, you know. But I think that middle, those doldrums happen whether you are a planner or a so-called pantser, writing on the fly. I just think it happens in different stages, you know, different parts of the A to Z process, you know. But I'm glad that I would rather front load all that horrible doubt and anxiety. But kind of along those lines of you know, moving the goalposts and you know, you mentioned, oh, well, if I have done it, it might not be that good. Something I sometimes experience is the sort of the post-performance dip, you know, like, oh, I have done the thing and, I used to be, well, I'm still a musician, but I used to be a performing musician. And that would happen so often after a gig, you know, that sort of short-term adrenaline rush. And it's just your body chemistry coming back to normal. But have you ever experienced anything like that with the longer marathon that is writing a novel? Like, almost like the celebration of getting to done is tempered by the, I'm done.
I find the process of writing and then publishing a novel takes so flipping long and has so many kind of milestones along the way that I'm almost never quite sure which bit to count as finished.
Right.
So I know what you mean about the kind of drop and but I think I often find that, you know, I finished a first draft and I can be like, good, I finished the first draft. Now I'm going to need to edit it. Okay. I finished final edits.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to need to submit it somewhere or, you know, send it to my publishers or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now there's more evidence. then we finish those and then there's a publication date. And then I've had my novels have been published first and then print a couple of months later. That's the model. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like, well, it's come out, but it's not out in hard form yet. So which counts? So I think for me, almost the little drop is more like, this is a thing, but it's not the last thing.
Right.
And I think when I finally hit the last thing that's definitely out in the world, yes, these days I try and do a sort of marketing push. And then I do get a bit of that drop, but I think it's more like I now don't know what's happening.
A little rudderless.
Sent out into the void. But if you're going to get any feedback, it's probably going to take a little while and there's, you know, not that much of it necessarily. So it's that kind of drop of, now what? Or I feel like there should be something more. There should be some trumpets.
Something that's come up in a couple of the conversations I've had in the last month or so with authors and writers is that necessary hubris, that sort of noble delusion that carries us from one project to the next. Like, yes, this is worthwhile because I say it is, and you people just need to figure it out. But it can keep you going, right? To just know, like you said, that it's better for me. You said this earlier, much earlier in the conversation, it's better for me if I write these things down than just keep them in my head. So there's that sense of I think we almost have to in some cases, you know, unless you are, you know, a James Patterson or whatnot, where you get plenty of validation from the dollars. I think there is this sense that we just kind of have to, you know, trust in our own self-importance.
Yeah. And also, I guess, in terms of, you know, defining success, trying to find that kind of success internally in that I have done justice.
Well, yeah.
The best I can at this time to this idea. And I think that's, you know, there's that sense of pushing your goals as you progress that goes along with sometimes you have to say, this book, this story, whatever, is as done as I can make it right
now. Yes, absolutely.
Like, maybe me in 5 years' time would do a better job of it, but I need to finish this one and start the next one.
Right, yeah. And the you in 5 years' time will
write someone else.
Yes, well, and you'll be someone else as an artist,
for sure.
You know? Yeah.
So yes, that kind of finding the success in having brought to a conclusion that you are satisfied with yourself, brought that idea through that process, and then just let it go out into the world and write the next thing. And I think I sometimes I have a whiteboard with a bunch of sort of post-it notes to remind me of ideas that I've come up with that I'm particularly keen on. And I sometimes think maybe success would be having written all of those ideas, like all of those, you know, I'm glancing over it now, like half a dozen different sort of novel size things that might be novel sized. But I also keep reminding myself that actually, by the time if I write all of those things, which I might not, because some more ideas are going to come along and they might be better, then I would have come up with some more ideas by the time I've written them.
Yeah.
So, and that's a good thing.
But yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm behind because I haven't written all of that. Like, no, I have all these cool ideas waiting for me. That is not being behind anything. That is just, I have a bunch of cool ideas. And sometimes you can squash two ideas into one, which both makes the ideas better and takes two post-it notes off the board. I like that.
Or you've had a post-it note up there for so long that you suddenly realize that
it's rubbish.
Well, I was going to go the other way. I was going to say that it's that it actually inspires an idea that is, for shorthand, I'll just say better than the thing that you had written down. You know, it becomes a springboard, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely happened to me. Or I've had like, 5,000 words of something because I got, I wrote a little bit about the characters and then we're like, I'm not quite there with a structure, a plot yet. And then 2 years later, I'm like, oh yeah, but if I do this other thing with those characters, that's going to be so much better. It's very satisfying.
That's very much like I was talking about my work in progress right now. And it's that moment where I was finally like, oh, that's what this is about. And floodgates open, but it takes time, you know.
Yes.
It takes time sometimes to get out of your own way.
And you were talking about pantser and plotter, and I've tended to be more of the pantser, although I've made myself become more of a plotter over time, simply because otherwise I write 25,000 words of something and then realize it's not going anywhere, which is a big waste of time. But I do still sometimes find that there's bits of that kind of, oh, what is this really about process that I can now shift into the planning phase. And there's bits of it that come out as I write, and that's the only way I can get out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no either or with that kind of stuff.
For sure.
And I think that's important to state, for the dear listener, you know, don't feel as if it is an either or, you know, because, and especially, speaking of social media, again, there's a lot of false dichotomy stuff where, are you this or that, you know?
Yeah. They're all lies. They're all spectrums.
Exactly.
There is no true dichotomy in anything, I think I'm going to say.
Yep. So we've talked about what you make and why you make it. And that's very nicely, all of this sort of stuff. I mean, there are three tent poles to the show, the making stuff and finding success and the last one that we're about to get to, but they all, of course, interweave and blur together and blend together. So in your writing life, what have you, if anything, what have you figured out that helps you manage it in whatever way you want to answer that? I mean, the portion of the conversation that this relates to is the part of the tagline of the show, which is "and stay healthy and sane in the process," right? You've talked about dealing with some self-doubt and some self-depreciation and some anxiety how those things have played in to the process and to the God help me, the creative journey. but what have you learned? What are some of the tricks or healthy practices that you've come across that seem to work for you? No guarantees it'll work for anybody else, but what have you found?
I think a few minutes ago I talked about, you know, learning to define success like more internally.
Yes.
Constantly then sort of chasing external goals so much. And I think that's been quite important, that stopping and appreciating that sense of, I have created this thing that I like, that I am proud of. And that is something, a success. And trying, the thing I found out only last year is how important it is for me to chase the fun bits, which is not to say that I have not been having fun in the, you know, 10 or so years that I've been sort of writing relatively regularly and quote unquote seriously. It's that I specifically, I was working on this big project that I've had to shelve for now, and I was a bit fed up. I was sort of sitting there thinking about it. And I was like, I don't exactly know what's wrong with it. And I've been given, you know, a friend read it and sort of gave me some really useful feedback. And I'm like, I'm not quite sure what to do with this. And then I was speaking to another writer friend, and they said, do you have another project you're working on? And I was like, no. And they were like, maybe you should. And I decided I was going to spend the summer just writing something that was fun, basically, that was just totally fun. I wasn't going to think about serious anything. This was just going to be all of the sort of ideas and tropes and things that I really love in the fiction I read. I was going to squash them all in together.
Awesome. Sounds great.
And it was a blast to write. I mean, obviously, there was phases of it that were easier than others. Sure. There always are, but basically it was a blast to write, because every time I started thinking, oh, well, you know, is this really working? I just shove in something else that I really like. and I finished it and I, you know, had a read through and edited it. And I was like, this is actually really pretty good. and it sounds absolutely absurd, but I was like, actually, it turns out that really enjoying what I was writing meant that I produced a better first draft. And I think a book that I'm more proud of, I'd almost put more of myself into it. I think maybe previously I'd enjoyed writing things and I'd been sort of, I'd had ideas of what I wanted to put into them, but I was slightly more distant. I was sort of slightly thinkier. This was quite an Yiddish book, if you know what I mean. This was quite a like, but lots of squashy feelings. And it came out really well. And I was like, that was fun. And I've come out with something I almost wasn't expecting. Like the point was, I'm just going to spend a month blasting through this, having a laugh, and maybe nothing will come of it. That's not the point. And the point is to unstick myself from this tricky project. But actually, it came out really well. So I was like, okay, do more of that.
Take a walk successful. In the woods instead of jog around the track. Yeah,
exactly. So that was an interesting insight into my own creative process. And I feel like a bit of a fool not having thought about it earlier. As I say, it's not that I haven't had fun writing. It was just that this was a particularly kind of shovel my interest into it. And it turns out that works quite well. And what else have I found useful? I talked earlier about, you know, the getting anxious about the sort of reception of my work and that kind of white knuckle process of the first book. And I manage that better now. I think that's partly through just having done it a few times.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it gets, you know, almost exposure therapy. It gets easier every time. and partly through, you know, sort of journaling and that kind of thing about, you know, what's actually going on in my head. I find journaling really useful for both writing purposes. The kind of artist's way style morning pages, like, I don't do 3 pages of longhand because I haven't got time these days. Before I had a child, I did 3 pages of longhand every morning.
For how long? Because I've tried that off and on over the decades.
I think I did it for 2 or 3 years most mornings, and then I had a kid, and it turns out that became quite difficult.
Very, very valid reason. Yes.
Yeah. And so these days I do sort of 1 to 3 pages on writing days, and don't really expect to. But I find that kind of offloading of the sort of in a narrative really useful. And I find it helps me.
Writing to figure out what you're thinking. Exactly.
And sort of offloading my brain onto the page. I find that incredibly useful. And sometimes it leads to thinking about the writing project that I'm working on. And sometimes it leads to thinking about a thing that's going on in my brain. And both of those are very handy and actually help me stay sane in a creative as well as a general way.
Sure.
And my feeling is that a lot of people get put off by it's supposed to be 3 pages. And I've found that 3 pages is better than one. Like, you get further through stuff, but one's better than none for me anyway. And in a kind of don't let the best be the enemy of the good way, I permit myself to do whatever fits into the time available and call that good.
The idea of permitting yourself is so important that it bears restating, you know. And you said it, you know, better to do 1 page than 3, because you showed up, you did it, you offloaded that stuff. You know, and yeah, I think it's easy to say, I'll speak for myself, but I think this is such a universal thing that we tend to, how can we not, right? Tend to judge what we're supposed to do based on what we've seen, you know, based on what we assume are the expectations. But just as you were chasing the fun bits, summer shows, you know, try just doing what you feel like and see where it goes. Permit yourself to do the thing that you feel like doing, you know. And no, I think that's very, very important. But go on. I just wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah. And in terms of making things and staying sort of sane and healthy, making things does make me feel better. I literally had that on a little piece of paper on my wall for a while because there was a while where I would sit down to write and then I would do nearly anything else. Because starting's hard, it is. There's like activation energy, and I would be like, oh, I don't quite feel like it. I'm not feeling great today. Maybe I won't do that. Maybe I'll do one of the many, many, many other things that there always are that you could usefully do in life. And it was often, it was often not even like, you know, scrolling Facebook or whatever. It was very often things like, the child needs a new pair of trousers. I'll just sort that, you know, I'll just go on, you know, the online and buy him some trousers, because very important job, needs trousers.
It's not like he's running around naked right this very instant.
Exactly. He does need trousers, but also that could maybe wait until this evening or another day. And so I wound up, I put this little piece of paper on my wall saying, writing makes you feel better, to remind myself that actually if I sit down and start the thing, then by the time I finish doing some writing, even like whatever it is, I feel better for it. I feel less good when I don't write stuff on a fairly regular basis.
Oh, yes.
And that's, reminding myself of that. And I do have to keep reminding myself of it, because it is still, you know, hard sometimes to sit down and do the thing, because it's more difficult than not doing the thing.
It's so easy to forget the positive. The reward side of it, for any number of reasons. You know, it's just easier to do other things, as you said, but also, you know, if we don't do the thing that is ultimately rewarding, that we intellectually know we feel good about doing, if we don't do that, then we don't have to face all those other squishy uncertainties that we talked about earlier, you know.
Oh, yeah, because all of that stuff is also true.
Exactly. Our brains really just want to keep us safe, right? And that means keeping us in the status quo and not pushing ourselves and not challenging ourselves.
Yes. Absolutely.
Damn thing.
And, you know, I find that remembering that, as you say, our brains try and keep us safe. Remembering that is really useful for me, and sort of working around it, being like, okay, so maybe I need to, there's bits of me that need a bit of sort of gentle cosseting. And that, you know, shouting yourself about it is not helpful. Finding ways to sort of ease that process. So, you know, I have personally found, I've been thinking a lot the last year or so about focus. Because I think, you know, we live in this very always on, always online world. And for me anyway, that is very attention fragmenting.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm aware that some people find this much less troublesome, but I do think that many people, and certainly for me, this is a big problem. It's not just that it shatters your attention, because, you know, I sit down and I'm like, I will start writing in a minute, but first I'm going to go and check the internet. And then it takes another 15 minutes for me to get back into thinking about the thing I'm supposed to be working on. But also for me, it's all these sort of attentional like threads. Like I'm now thinking about that thing that my friend said maybe on, you know, on Slack, or I'm thinking about this piece of news, or I'm thinking about, you know, somebody else's problem, which might even, you know, be important, but maybe it can wait. So for me, turning off all of that stuff and using, you know, shutting down my browser the night before, I'm going to pick up my laptop in the morning and putting on music to shut out the noises off in the house and all of this kind of really trying to protect my attention and focus makes me feel better. And it means I'm better able to sit down and write the stuff that I really want to write, and trying to really hold that sense of, actually, I've chosen to prioritize this thing in my life. It is important to me to do these creative things. There are other things that are important in my life, and I want to try and focus on those when I'm doing them, like, you know, spending time with my kid or my friends and family. Those are important things too. But, you know, right now, the space that I'm in when I sit down in front of the laptop, that is space for writing. And that's trying to protect that attention has been really important for me, and has, I have found it massively reduces my anxiety levels, which is something I've struggled with off and on for a while. And I do feel like the kind of the nature of the sort of information fire hose that we now get exposed to is really anxiety inducing for a lot of people. Like there's just so much stuff.
Yeah.
So much stuff out there.
Yeah.
And I don't think that being mega anxious for most people is conducive to creativity. And I don't think that being mega anxious is, for the vast majority of people, conducive to anything useful, actually.
Right.
So, yeah, that's been really important for me lately, trying to, I guess, regather my attention and stop it from shattering off onto all the many, many other different places that it could go to, and just spending sort of having this time that I sit down and focus on creating the stuff that I want to create.
I like it so much. Yeah, I have a similar thought, and I call it paying myself first. And which is not, I didn't make up that term. It's a, you know, a time management kind of thing, but the idea that do not feel bad about carving this time out for this thing that you know is both immediately and potentially rewarding, you know? And the focus thing, oh boy. Yeah. I have a couple of tricks that I've stumbled upon. Unfortunately, they both involve actually getting to the point where I'm about to write. So I got to get that far at least. Right. but once I'm there, I use for the actual writing session. I mean, I'll copy paste it out of that into, you know, whatever I'm actually kind of constructing the story in. But for the actual writing session, I use this full page, full screen editor called Q10. And the only reason I've stuck with this one, and I think it's Windows only, I'll put a link in the show notes, but it doesn't let you do any formatting. You can't do italics. You can't, you know, nothing like that. It's plain text. But it has some nice shortcuts with the function keys. So you can, you know, do things like insert a timestamp or whatever. I like to do that at the beginning and the end of each session. But the best thing, and the thing that has helped, it helps me stay in the writing while I'm there, is every keystroke is mapped to the sound of a typewriter key.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And that rhythm, that tick, 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 you know, and it even when you come to the end of the line, it does the ding. And that rhythm, that sound, you put the headphones on and all I can hear is literally myself typing. There's some sort of biofeedback that happens there that keeps me in it. And for more like thinky, planny bits of the writing process. You talk about focus. Well, I found an app called Focus at Will.
Oh yeah, yeah. I used to use that one. But it's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's quite good. The only drawback to that is if you've used it for a while, you start to realize, Boy, they really haven't added any music to this in a long time. And that in itself becomes distracting. It's like, I'm hearing this same instrumental guitar piece for the, I might as well be on hold for the bank or something, you know. But yeah, I think everything that you've said is really valuable, because that finding and keeping focus and recognizing the benefits, to that, to allowing yourself that, to giving yourself permission to that, all of that stuff. So if this is kind of corny, but I do like closing the show with this. If you could take everything that you've learned across, you said it's been a decade or so, and of course longer than that, before,
I've been writing since I was a kid, I stopped for a bit and went back to it.
If you could take
everything I've learned,
everything that you've kind of learned and experienced, and distill it down to something that would fit on a bumper sticker or a coffee mug, what do you think that ridiculously, impossibly pithy statement would be?
Allow yourself to prioritize doing this.
Yeah.
And that it's, you know, that's the bumper sticker version. The long one is, you know, it is okay to say this is something that's important to me and that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And to allow what that means, you know, to carve out that time and to say, I'm going to be busy right now. Mm-hmm. Allow yourself to prioritize this.
And that's hard, because we're not always in control of that, you know,
and also sometimes, you know, one can feel guilty at sort of saying, actually, you know, I'm not available to do whatever it is somebody else wants me to do.
Right. And finding the right, everything, the right environment, the right people, in your life, to support that. And what I mean by that, you know, in every way, just to not invalidate that. Can be a challenge. I mean, and whether it's intentional or not, or whether it's just circumstantial or not, I mean, having a child I don't have any kids, but I'm sure that that's a big one. Like, okay, the biggest priority in my life is my offspring. But this other thing is still a priority.
Yes, I think that's the key to it. Like, trying to, if you are trying to prioritize two things, or to say sometimes you don't always have to be 100% available, especially as they get bigger.
Yes, yes.
Somebody else can do the job for a bit. With toddler stage was tricky, because toddlers don't really understand or find it difficult to understand I'm busy now. I'm in the house, but I'm busy.
So is there anything across the course of our conversation that maybe you wanted to go deeper on, or that we missed, or that you'd like to circle back on?
I think the only other thing I remember making was made a note of when I talked earlier about having all the sort of post-it notes on the board and waiting for them. You know, thinking of myself as behind. I'm not behind. They're just lovely ideas that I can come to. But it reminded me of an advice I saw from someone about writing, which is that you shouldn't like save your cool ideas for sort of, you know, the right moment. You should just shove as many of them in as you can to any given, you know, don't think, oh, I'll keep that idea for another project. Nah, shove it in. You'll have another good idea.
Use
ideas profligately, because the more cool ideas you use and shove together and put into your projects, the more cool ideas will show up in your brain later. And I think that's another way to like chase the fun, like shovel the ideas in, cram your projects full of cool stuff.
That's fantastic, because I mean, let's face it,
there's always more cool stuff where that came from.
There's always more cool stuff. And let's face it, that's what we love. Universally, we love to be awed, right? When we're reading or experiencing something, it's like, look at, did you see that? Can you believe what she wrote? You know? Yeah. I think that's great.
And I think the more, and you know, in that, back to that idea of having fun with writing, I think some of that is about it being yourself that you put into it. Mm-hmm. And that's like the thing you said about, you know, you're writing stuff for people who like this kind of stuff you write, really leaning into that sense of this is what I write and this is what, and this is that's more appealing than writing something that's less self, yeah. I think.
And the idea, I mean, for me, that sort of truism, it ties into everything. It ties into the marketing too, because it frees you to not worry about the people who aren't buying your book, the people who aren't following you, the people who aren't on your mailing list, because they're not your community. They're you know, it sounds a little Machiavellian, but those people don't matter. You know, the ones that do matter are the ones that are there. They're the ones that are reading the book, the ones that are buying the book, the ones that are leaving the reviews, you know. It doesn't make those people who aren't into you any less of a person or anything like that. It's just allow, you know, it gives you the freedom to reduce that sort of fear of missing out, right? Because you're not missing out on those people. They've got their own thing.
yeah, absolutely.
Well, this has been great. Get another conversation where I think that the listener is going to get a heck of a lot out of it. And this is my goal, is to talk to folks in a way that the end result is something that can be listened to tomorrow or 3 weeks from now or 10 years from now. And a writer out there is going to go, yep. So Juliette Kemp, thank you so much for being on Sauna Totem.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun. I've had a great time.
And there you have it, my friends, my conversation with the fantasy and science fiction author Juliette Kemp, whose work you can find at JulietteKemp.com. That's JulietteKemp.com. If you found some value in what we discussed, or if you have any comment at all, yay or nay, I invite you to leave a comment in the show notes for this episode, Sauna Totem episode 105. Just go over there to mattselznick.com/saunatotem-105. That's mattselznick.com/saunatotem, SONITOTUM-105. mattselznick.com/saunatotem-105. Or you can send an email to matt@mattselznick.com. Or even if you like, record a brief voice message, maybe on your phone, and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. No matter how you decide to provide your feedback for this episode, I will reply to you, whether it's a reply in the comment section of the show notes or an email. Or if you do record a voice message, I'll play it in a future episode of the show and respond right here on the proverbial time-shifted air. Hey, if you love the show, you didn't just like the conversation, but you love the show, I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review Sauna Totem with Matthew Wayne Selznick in the podcast app or platform of your preference, right? This is how it works. This is how we do things. This is how podcast listeners help more people discover the podcasts they love, and in doing so, help that podcast reach an even bigger audience and keep going. And, you know, by that podcast, I'm talking about this one. So whether you listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube Podcasts, wherever, please take a moment to rate, take a few minutes longer to review Sauna Totem. It really does make a difference. And you know what else is awesome? Subscribing for free to Sauna Totem, wherever you get your podcasts. Whatever app you're using, it's got a little button that says subscribe. Do that for this show and you will never miss an episode. You know how it works. You're not new to this stuff. Okay, very good. You know, before the conversation with Juliette Kemp, I mentioned that
you might be able to get one of three of my books for free. I'm offering you your choice of either my fantasy thriller, Light of the Outsider, or my 1980s sort of kind of young adult superpowers coming of age novel, Brave Men Run, or my literary collection of short stories and related essays, Four Stories, for free. One of those, it's yours when you join the Multiversalists, my community of readers, writers, friends, and fans at the free level. Just go to mattselznick.com/freebook, all one word, and you'll be able to select the book of your choice and get all signed up. You can also just go to mattselznick.com and you'll see the free book menu item there in the menu bar. If you really love the show and you want to support it and help offset the costs that go into making it, as well as my other creative endeavors, and get a whole bunch of cool perks and access and extra content, well, then you'll take the extra step, the deeply honored step of becoming a patron member multiversalist, like Zoe Cohen Lay and J.C. Hutchins and Jim Lewinson and Amelia Bowen and Ted Lainhart and Charles Eugene Anderson. Join these fine folks for $4.17 a month if you pay annually. You can pay more for more perks and more access, but it starts at just $50 a year. Go to mattselznick.com/be a patron. mattselznick.com/be a patron. All one word, all lowercase, and so on and so forth. Or, of course, you can go to mattselznick.com and just click the Join the Community button. Your patronage is amazing. And I really want to thank the folks who have been there for, in some cases, years. Join them at mattselznick.com/be a patron and find out what it's all about. Okay. Coming in hot and fast on this one because it's been a long time since the last episode. And I haven't had a whole lot of time in my life. And I still don't, even this very day. So trying to keep it lean, trying to keep most of the content, that excellent conversation with Juliet Kemp, and just share with you the bare minimum stuff. I'll have more to say in more depth and at length about what's going on in my creative life, as well as some things that, as always, I hope you're going to find useful and valuable and interesting to help your own creative process and stuff in a couple of weeks when we do a solo episode. A couple of weeks after that, in episode 107, I'll be back with another conversation all about media tie-ins. You know, those books that are connected to movies or games, you know. I'm sure some of you have probably read a Star Wars book or a Star Trek book or an X-Files book, or maybe read some Forgotten Realms novels. Well, I'm going to be talking to a woman who's written a bunch of that stuff for some franchises that you will be very familiar with. So that's two episodes from now, my conversation with Rosemary Jones. 2 weeks from now, give or take, episode 106, it'll just be you and me. 2 weeks after that, episode 107, we'll be talking media tie-ins with Rosemary Jones. I hope you subscribe so that you don't miss those episodes. And hey, thanks for listening. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.